Okay, let's get started. Every now and then I can be nagged into actually doing a series that I've done past. The reason why this time was successful is that there was no recorded audio nor video of Can God Meet Emotional Needs, nor of the Perception and Performance series, which people had said was really helpful. So I've spent the last few months thinking about feeling, which was really draining. Probably not as bad as feeling about thinking, which would have been like really confusing. But I am looking forward to doing boy, a bunch of sermons on this. We're going to add some more things that deal with loneliness, depression, the downward death spiral, and a few other topics that you can probably cajole me into doing in the near future. So I first did this. Got me to emotional needs almost 20 years ago. And I kind of started studying emotions because I'd never heard of them before back maybe almost 40 years ago. And I did so because when I was going to seminary, it dawned on me that something's not right here. It seemed that counseling had replaced discipleship as the mission of the church. And I actually brought that up to some of my professors, and they said, "Yes, that's right," as if that was the way it was supposed to be. And basically, the whole secular mindset has permeated the church so that people are looking for secular solutions to things that are ultimately spiritual problems. So I'm going to be talking about some of the stuff I found, particularly in the past few weeks. And it reinforced what I had discovered a couple decades ago and added a few new things and actually wound up confusing me at a higher level than I was before. So I guess that's progress. I don't have the resolution that I would normally have, but hopefully everything I say will be helpful and I know it's at least defensible. So, since I'm going to be delving into the world of secular psychology, I thought it'd be good to probably start with the scriptures. And then we'll actually touch the scriptures a couple times, so I don't, get bent out of shape if I don't talk about the scriptures as I normally do. But I want you to kind of understand what's going on out there and how you can approach these same objectives that secular counseling has from a biblical perspective, so God gets glory. So, can God meet emotional needs? Absolutely. All you have to do is read the Psalms and you realize there is a lot of emotional needs going on there. In fact, there's a whole category called Psalms of Lament for those people who break things up into categories. There's another category called basically you're lamenting because people have done bad things to you. Then there's another category called imprecation, which basically means you desire horrible things to happen to the people who have done horrible things to you. So, like, may the fleas of a thousand camels infest your armpits or something like that. It's just, it's not really a Bible verse. Most of you knew that. But throughout the scriptures, we actually get lots of examples of people who have emotional needs that don't really get met. And it doesn't look like it ends happily ever after. But as the Bible says, it ain't over till the fat lady sings. Oh, wait, that's the song about opera. But the story is not fully written yet. Job, one of the first books of the scriptures in chronological order, is really about a guy going through incredible emotional turmoil. There's this thing called the Passion. You might have heard about Jesus, who had this incredibly emotionally difficult task here on earth. And I'm talking about training the 12 apostles, not getting actually crucified, which was, part of God's plan to begin with. So, speaking of Jesus, we have him as a great high priest. A high priest is one who interceded to God for the needs of the people they represented, and he represents us. He has passed from earth into the heavens. He's Jesus, the Son of God. Since we have this, let's hold fast our profession of our faith, our confidence and trust in him, and his ultimate triumph in our lives. Because we do not have a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities. says the New King James Version. So that means he gets our feelings. He's been tempted in every way that we were tempted, and he managed to basically be victorious through it. So he can help us. Let us come boldly to the throne of grace. This is going to talk about prayer, that we may obtain mercy for where we need help and forgiveness, and find grace to help in time of need. So Jesus is seated at the right hand of the Father, interceding for us. The Spirit is also praying for us. God's for us. He wants to help us. And he has the means and the ability. We just have to figure out how he wants to do that. And his goal is not a quick fix Band-Aid. His goal is to actually do a little heart surgery, little brain surgery, and change the way we think and feel about life, so that we can then go out and do that to others and giving them, you know, being good stewards of the grace of God. So that's why I have Romans 12, 1 and 2 there. This whole transformation process is really what goes on if you peel back all the layers of therapy. So, you know, we live in New York. I'm sure the majority of people you know are either in or have been in therapy. And if you look at what goes on in therapy, it's actually somebody developing a relationship with you to try to shift your thinking. And you wind up shifting your thinking sometimes because you get insight into the fact that, oh yeah, that's the way it's supposed to be. But often you shift your thinking just because you don't want to lose the relationship with this person that will give you attention and listen to you. Of course, you have to pay them, you know, what, $200 an hour to do that? I mean, there are other ways you can spend $200 an hour to get therapy. But we're going to kind of delve into how the thinking process changes. And it's helpful. There are some helpful insights into basically when life doesn't work like you want it to, which causes us to get all fussy and pouty and depressed. So we're going to take a look at some fun things. At least I find them fun, and I really that's all that matters. but I, you know, back in college, I at one point was a neurobiology major until I satisfied my curiosity. And I've often said if they had just like personal brain scanners, I would still be doing that because there's just some phenomenal stuff that we can understand about how God has made us, which helps us live more successfully, victoriously, if we understand it. So as I started studying this, I always ask myself questions, and then I think about it, and then I go ask the great Google for answers, and I read a bunch of articles, and normally I see something that resonates and says, oh yeah, that's it. This time, I read hundreds of articles, and none of them resonated. None of them said, that's it. It's like when I first got involved in a Bible study, and it was in James 2, and there was a group of Catholics on one side who believed in salvation by works, and a group of Baptists on another side believing in salvation by faith. And they were both giving their party lines, and I'm there listening to this, my very first study, saying, I don't know what the answer is, but neither of these guys are right. And then as I'm looking at this, I'm realizing, I don't know what the answer is, but nobody that I read so far is actually right, where I can make, you know, sure. And I even went back to my good friend Aristotle, who normally is, my voice of reason in the midst of the crazy emotional turmoil of the current day. And he was inconsistent. Oh. Yeah, and he basically contradicts himself. And I'm thinking, Aristotle's contradicting himself? Wow, this must be a really bad topic. So I'm going to look at some of these things, and I'm going to hopefully bring you some resolution. I can guarantee you that I can, by the end of the series, you will know how God meets your emotional needs. You will trust him to meet your emotional needs, and it will happen. If you just follow what the scriptures say. So you can look at some of the outlines, get an idea where I might be going. But I'm going to first address the question of what is a emotion versus a feeling? So to answer that, I discovered someone did research paper dissertation, they published a paper who basically started out with the same question I had. And they discovered that there are 92 different definitions of emotions in the scientific literature. And they don't agree. 92 different perspectives. And nobody says, that's it. Well, actually, some of those say, yeah, well, that's it, and that's it. And then you have to realize, there are like five or six people who say that's it, and then under each one of these things. So I turned to my old friend, the dictionary, the Oxford English Dictionary, among others. And, normally, Oxford English Dictionary is hard to find, and they're a little ponderous. So I will do the Webster's Dictionary, Merriam-Webster, and very unsatisfying because the dictionary said emotions are feelings and feelings are emotions. And okay, so look up emotions again. Wait, this is like feelings, and it's just like, it took me like 15 minutes to get out of that loop. It was terrible. I found out that there were dozens of ways of characterizing or categorizing emotions. The thing I normally like to look up is something called a taxonomy, where they've kind of, people have spent decades trying to figure out how things go. And I found out that there are dozens of people who spent dozens of years trying to figure out how things went, and they don't agree. I looked at the neurobiological basis of our feelings or emotions, and this is really cool because I was expecting, oh, this is going to be great because I'll find out when, this happens, this part of your brain lights up, and then I got the link, and I got these links, but these links go all over the place. It's not consistent, and I'll turn you on in a couple weeks to a map that kind of actually tries to do a picture of where things are in your brain and what they're related to and what's next to them and how these things work, but you have about a 3.5 pound lump in between your ears that has 100 billion neurons. Those are these little nerve cells, 100 billion. But each of them has about 10,000 connections, which gives you, I think, someone came up with this number, 10 to the 22 possible distinct connections. That is more than all the atoms in our universe. Actually, if you're in the universe, then just you are more than all those things. It's just like it's a very, very complex thing. And in oh, what is it, 1960, there were like 100 papers written on emotions. This last decade, there were 2,000 papers written. And the scientific research is coming to the point where they're saying, and we're not going to know this, but I'm sure there's an answer. And I also understand why it's so difficult. So I want to take a look at, I should almost do the definition, but the concept of neurological or biological drives, things that are hardwired into the way God made you. And then those drives actually give rise to emotions. An emotion is something that moves you to motion. And then those emotions give rise to something that you can sense or feel. And then that will give rise to your actions. So we're going to look at how that works. People have boiled down the drives to four, and these are actually not even correct. Mad, glad, sad, and scared. So you get mad, you get angry, you fight or flight. Glad, you're happy. Sad, you're not happy. Bad is you feel bad about yourself, which is a form of sad. And then there's the whole scared thing, where you are doing a fight flight thing and you are running. So those seem to, I'll tell you how they actually came up with those in a few minutes. They're called innate drives. So they drive us to action. And that is my favorite kind of concept of what an emotion is. It's what puts you into motion, as opposed to puts you into a feeling. So it drives you, but there's an eight drivers. You are born with these things. We're going to explore a little bit very shortly how those things kind of work. But the thing that makes it so difficult is they get reshaped by how you process them. We'll get there in a minute or two. And we're also going to just briefly touch on, in this outline, the difference between an emotional need or emotional desire. I'm going to see a quote where somebody talks about, having a birthday party or watching NFL Monday Night Football is an emotional need. Well, I'm sorry, that is an emotional desire. You might think it's a need, but that doesn't prevent you from doing the will of God. So a need is something that actually has to absolutely be there in order for you to do the will of God. And the way you think or feel can actually incapacitate you. So you do not do what God wants you to do, which means you can actually override his plan by thinking and feeling incorrectly. So this is going to sound a little, what's the word for it? Obtuse. But I want it to be kind of accurate. You have innate, that means neurobiological, hardwired drives. Okay, that makes you decide to just not be a mass of protoplasm, laying on the mud. You actually get up and do things. These things, we're going to look at this process, lead to what I call constructed emotions. All right? So there are two major camps. One is that everything is innate. The other camp is that everything is learned. And the correct answer is yes. It starts at innate and then it's learned, and then the learned behavior changes the innate. You actually can rewire your brain, which is a good thing because you're not stuck in wherever you happen to be. So it's const your I call these filters a little bit later. Those of you familiar with some of my earlier work will know that. You get experiences and you learn values. So let me just take this idea of you have a fight or flight response. So if you basically are walking down the path and you hear this rattle, 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 and you look and there's this giant rattlesnake about, poised, ready to eat you, what would you do? Actually, bite you. You would run. Now, if a little baby is crawling down the path and hears a rattle, 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 they think, ah, it's another baby. And they will go and play with the nice snakey, because they haven't learned that that's something to run from. Kids have to actually be taught this. Oh, traffic. Yeah, I'm going to go play in traffic. Looks like it's fun. They haven't learned that that's a bad thing because then they get, squished into a pancake. So there's these whole societal values are actually pretty significant in shaping how we feel about things. And somewhere I might tell you that something you've heard probably more than you'll want to hear about, Jill's and mine responses to spiders. I basically get bitten by a spider. It hurts for over a week. I can't sleep. I was bitten on a finger, and I couldn't get to sleep for a week. Just like I feel like gnawing at my finger to try to get the thing to stop hurting me. She thinks spiders are your friends because that's the way she was raised. So if we get a spider, and it's kind of like smaller than a cupcake, I'll take a flip flop and go after it. If it's bigger than a cupcake, I'll basically ask Jill to herd it outside, where it will wait to bite me the next time I go out. I just know it's lurking there. If it's bigger than a dinner plate, then this biological urge to protect me and mine, I will go get a tennis racket, a can of some noxious chemicals, and I will go after that spider. So I have different responses based to the perceived threat. How do I feel about it? Well, I guess I feel a little fear, hesitation, and then I realize, come on, I'm bigger than the spider. I can squish it. But if once they get bigger and bigger, then I basically the feelings almost don't enter in, and that is one of the hallmarks, according to psychologists, of emotions is that you don't think about them. So you're driving, a car cuts you off, you don't have to think, car in front of me. I will probably hit it if it continues in that trajectory. So maybe I should consider turning the wheel. No, it's like an emotion. It actually is very beneficial. God wired us to have these kind of responses. Invading horde coming in, throwing spears and arrows. Duck. Point the end another guy. Yeah, it's like fight. Those things come in. You don't have to think a large amount about them. So emotions, we're going to see, are learned. They are cultural, building on our innate drives. And I don't think I came across anybody who actually makes that distinction. There might have been something, but it was written in some Eastern European language. Maybe it was Polish, and I couldn't get the translator to work real well. But they seem to be saying the right thing. So the emotions then get expressed as feelings. That's how I feel. Now, a feeling I am more aware of than I am of my emotion. We tend not to be aware of our emotions. And I've got a wheel that hopefully I'll get to today that will. Anybody know what time it is? Thank you. A wheel that will actually, and I'll definitely work on it in future weeks, that can help you actually trace your emotions and get better in touch with them so you can then kind of examine them and change them. So the feelings are things that you are aware of. I feel sad. I feel glad. I feel miserable. I feel disdain, disgust. I mean, there's like all these, you have to be a linguist to basically have any facility in understanding the conclusions that people found through these studies. You also need to be part neurobiologist, you need to be part psychologist, you need to be part counselor, you need to be part human achievement coach. All those things basically gather together to try to understand the human experience. And the problem is that almost all the PhDs are narrow focused on their particular specialty and they can't overlap with other disciplines. And as a result, they all get it's like someone gave the example, which I'm sure you've all heard of, five blind men and the Indian elephant. And they each got the part of the elephant and they think, oh, yeah, it's like a rope. Oh, yeah, it's like, a leaf. It's like they kind of don't get the big picture. And then most of the people who aren't specialists aren't given any credence to the by the academic community because, it's personal security in their position. And I have a couple of guys down, we'll also see down below, that are going to be helpful. Okay, so I got a drive that actually causes me to feel a certain way, I mean, respond a certain way. Through an emotional perceptual filter, then I express it through another filter, and then that, here's a neat piece, shapes my perceptions. So there are times that you ever hear or talk to someone where you're thinking, or maybe you've experienced this yourself, you emotionally short circuit, you're just stuck, you can't get out of the thing that you're thinking of. And that is not good because it renders you incapable of action, frequently action that relates to, God's will for your life. A guy called Golem, who did a seminar with the Dalai Lama, and they were basically studying how, contemplative monks in Tibet, how their brain lights up and, different things that you can learn from it. And one of the findings that was discussed in this, kind of scientific inquiry, I think was titled, is that your emotions and feelings actually do totally distort your perception. So there's stuff that you can't see. And one of the questions I have down below is, well, if that happens, how do you actually get out of, this imbalanced perception of life to be able to solve your issues? And that is something that maybe we'll get to. Eventually, we'll do it. And the last thing that happens is those perceptions then create your mood. I had a friend who was telling me that someone basically started off their day with an argument with someone else, and then it just shaped the way they saw everything, the way they shared everything. And this is like classic where, a guy has a bad day at work, he comes home and he snaps at the wife, who snaps at the kid, and the kid goes and kicks the dog. It's like, yeah. Dog abuse. I know it's a terrible thing. We have to talk about that one day. But anyway, this is kind of how you've got drives. Those drives create emotions based on what you valued. So we're going to have to deal with a learned value. Then that will express itself in how you feel, and then eventually see things, act, and it can be a downward spiral or it can be an upward spiral. So that is kind of the mess we're heading into. This is a wheel. I can never read these things. I still can't even figure out all these things. They're like, don't see the colors. But it's Pinchek or something like that. He's on your sheet. He tried to basically split it into eight different emotional dimensions, and you can actually go on his site and there's a quiz. I didn't take it. I wanted to look at it before I recommended it, but I didn't have time. So the thought is that if you're feeling something on the outside of this wheel or flower or whatever you want to call it, then you can trace it into the core thing to understand how things function. And then you can also see where it leads if you don't address it. So I guess the further out you get, the more intense it is. So there's some interesting things like that. And basically, when you develop emotional intelligence, which is one of Goleman's big thing, you are aware of your emotions, you're aware of what causes them, and understanding the problem is a great way towards solving it. Failure to understand it, it's like, you just kind of bounce from one doctor to another and they never diagnose what's wrong with you. So you don't want to have that. So you want to kind of gain your self-awareness. To go a little deeper into our neurobiological drives and motivations, the thing I want to point out is these are modifiable. And I'll give you some examples. Yes, somewhere down at the bottom. So survival is really big. That is kind of an eight. A kid doesn't actually know what to do to survive. Baby alligator breaks out of the shell and is ready to snap off your finger. They are perfectly capable of doing that, instinctual. Human babies, they might try to snap off your finger, but they don't really know what they're doing. They don't even have teeth yet. So we kind of have to learn it. But as people develop and you look at societies and you look at how they function and you look at what archaeologists uncover, survival of self is really key. However, you have examples of self-sacrifice. You have people like Homer going out to fight Achilles, knowing he's going to get killed. He's like, why is he doing that? So there's physical survival. This is why you do things like eat. It's kind of helpful. And another one that I do not think people have, maybe I saw one or two people that kind of obliquely address this. Freud might have done it more, but I didn't spend any much time on him, is ego survival. When I look at what people do, and when I look at what they will sacrifice their physical well-being for, it's all about ego. Why do people feel the need to challenge, the next person up in the hierarchy, risking life and everything else? Ego survival is huge. The whole concepts of self-worth will fit underneath there. So you not only want the self-survival, you also want the species survival, which is the whole idea of, procreate and sex and that kind of stuff. Another thing that is pretty well documented and hardwired, we're born with a desire to move from pain to pleasure, away from pain to pleasure. Okay, this is why, the kid learns to not touch the stove and to eat the box of Oreos. So it's a move away from one to the other. And then, God made us this way. So pain is a sign that something isn't quite right. So when we do the perception performance stuff, particularly some of the stuff from Tony Robbins, I think he's done some really good work in terms of helping people figure out what the pain is telling them and what actions they should take. And that's actually, emotions number four on the perception and performance thing, if you want to see what he says before I actually get there. Here's a thing which doesn't show up in a lot of the things, but I have this really great evidence, both sociologically, from what you can observe, and neurobiologically, that we are driven to relationships. We are wired for them. And we're going to look at, I have the mirror neuron, yeah, I've got the mirror neurons coming up. And then last one of these big four, actually the first one is two, second one's kind of two, is to acquire things, acquire status, acquire stuff. Every time, animals do this too, like crows are famous for, they want to acquire stuff. Humans, we do it too. And when archaeologists like will undo a dig, They find stuff that tells about the world because people have acquired stuff. They just, that's probably one of them. This is a joke. Major reasons people actually settled down. It wasn't agriculture. It was just they needed a place to keep their stuff. All right. So this is what we do. And there are things that are wired to pleasure when we get stuff, which diminishes once your iPhone goes dead. From some of the biblical stuff and the way God has wired us before, you're all aware of power, pleasure, and possessions. I broke those up a little bit based on trying to encompass the stuff I was reading from the psychological world. Power is still there, and a big desire for power is security. Then underneath that is, or alongside of that, is preservation. So preservation of the species, and that's where fight and flight comes in, as well as propagation. So you basically you realize the saber-toothed tiger is bigger than you are. You need help. You run away. If you're really hungry, then you go out to fight the saber-toothed tiger, but you bring some buddies who are really good with spears. We're wired for pleasure, not just the procreation, sex and affection stuff, but we're wired to move from pain to pleasure. So pleasure is, God is all for pleasure. He created us with pleasure sensors, and at his right hand are pleasures forevermore. He opens up his hand and satisfies the desire of every living thing. And there's the whole possession things. God gives us all things richly to enjoy, but make sure you share. And I saw possessions, I never quite, kind of got into the whole possession thing. But when I put it in a tribal context, I realized, wow, like significance or status is gained by possessions. I saw someone with a coat trimmed with ermine or whatever that is, and he's from a place where you didn't have that stuff. And that was a big deal. You see the people with the tiger heads, in tribal groups that, or lion heads that they met. They basically are showing their status through what they have. People try to acquire things and skills. So, all that, a lot of this stuff goes for self-worth. So under possessions, I could even just put self-worth, which is a function of significance. Right there, significance, right there. Yeah, normally I say power, security, and significance, and it is, but I broke it up this way based on some of the findings. Now, there are some things that are actually going at odds, and we're going to see as we go through it that there are a lot of these desires that we have that conflict with each other. And the idea is to kind of be balanced, which I kind of figured out even before I read the Buddhist stuff. Self-preservation is you keep your identity. It's like individuality. But the thing that you kind of also need is trust. And trust of some other person makes you vulnerable. Why? Because people are untrustworthy. The only friend that's trustworthy totally is Jesus. So there's this balance where you have to kind of live as an individual, and that's an important thing to have an individual identity, and then live in a community with a society of people where you have relationships and they are held in tension. You can't just go all for one or all for the other. And then I discovered in kind of an oblique reference, someone mentioned mirror neurons. And I thought, what are neurons? I've never seen a mirror neuron before. I looked in the mirror, I didn't see, couldn't see any. So when we do something, a certain part in our prefrontal cortex, or somewhere up between our ears near the front, lights up. So I move my arm, bing, lights up. Okay, now here's the thing that's cool. If I see someone else move their arm, in the neurons that are just underneath those ones that initially lit up, both they and the initial one will light up. So it mirrors what I see. So there's some cool pictures of a guy sticking his tongue out at a baby, which I would do all the time anyway, discussing that baby. And the baby mirrors it. Like we're talking about kids that are like a week old. They will mirror what a, I guess, adult will do. Well, if you're sticking your tongue out at a baby, you're not being very adult. But I remember I was making a noise, the first noise that Chantilly made, R. She made R, I did R back. And we're So I was mirroring her, she was mirroring me. We just had a great conversation. It's the best one I've ever had. It's like, really anxious to communicate at a very young age, like a month old, less than that. So mirror neurons are what enable us to learn. When we see somebody do something, it will fire the same action in us. Two little things on this. If we see someone get touched, we will imagine we're being touched. And then the only thing that kind of totally doesn't muddle our mind is we have sensors in our skin. And if it doesn't give feedback that, dude, you're being touched, then we'll realize it's a false signal. I'm not being touched. Otherwise, you kind of walk and you see everybody, and then you're like, ah, they're all touching me. It's the other thing that's kind of interesting about this is if you basically go to a psych experiment, these people are really sadistic, and you get shocked, right? They measure your brain, you get lit up. You have a friend, they get shocked. Your mirror neurons fire, and you feel the pain that they feel if you're close to them. If a person you don't like a coworker, pointy-haired boss, or whatever, gets shocked, it has no impact on you. That part of the brain does not light up. That kind of tells you we're built for and wired for empathy, that we can bear each other's burdens because we feel for them. And then this actually is a whole bunch of stuff you can learn on mirror neurons. Basically, people who are close to us actually become part of us in our brains. So that's more to that to come later. So we are hardwired for learning. So one of the ways I learned to cook is one of my first jobs is I was a pot washer in this really great restaurant next to a superstar chef who basically overdosed at the age of 28. And I would watch him and I learned how to do this stuff. And I had some very active mirror neurons that if I see something, I usually can figure out. If I read something, I can basically imagine myself doing it. And there's a lot of stuff I know how to do. I've just never done it before. But when I'm in a situation, it's like the brain says, okay, you know how to do this. And it follows. We are hardwired for empathy. Trouble is, we don't always want to feel others' pain. That's why guys always want to solve problems because I don't want to feel this. Let's get this pain out of here. Well, she says, but this is what I'm feeling. You're rejecting me if you reject my feelings. We're hardwired for friendship. And this is astounding that this would come out of the secular. We're hardwired for God. It's actually moral right and wrong, people are saying, is neurobiologically, the wires have been laid down for that. Which, of course, is like, gee, how did that ever evolve? Our minds want to know. Okay, now values should be somewhere in one of my definitions are really key because this is how we actually can manage our emotions by managing and changing our values. So if I wanted to be less, frantic and have panic attacks when I see giant spiders, I don't have arachnophobia. I just don't like big things that bite me. Values can override our drives and our emotions. Just a couple little examples. Hunting. You go out to hunt a woolly mammoth. A woolly mammoth could turn you into a pancake. They're really scary. But something overrides the desire for being safe and secure from stampeding woolly mammoths. It's called, I need a mammoth steak to get through the winter. So you have this, value of living longer term with food than you do for risking getting stomped, and you go hunting. Honor, I'll give you the example of Homer going out to face Achilles. Did it for duty, honor, and country. Character overrode his desire for self-preservation. Defense, the guys who went on, to basically help rescue the troops on D-Day. They basically were willing to sacrifice themselves. It's like, mothers sacrificing themselves for their kids. And then I went to some of the more mundane stuff, the desire for minimalism. So some people do it as an art form, like, Oh, I just always love the way those Japanese don't have to have any furniture in their house. So I want to get rid of all that stuff. Others do it because I'm just fed up with all the stuff. I just got to get rid of it. It's slowing me down. And but they have a higher value than having the stuff. It's I don't want to have to make the decision. What do I do? I got too many things in my closet to wear. Let's look at you have the desire for eating, but they also have a desire for dieting. So some value overrides the primal instinct to eat. Exercise, comfort versus pain. There's something. Abstinence versus gratification. You can basically override your emotions and actually change your emotions by changing your values. So if you learn nothing else from today, that's the thing. You want to develop biblical values so you can eventually have want to do the biblically correct thing as opposed to, oh, I gotta do this. Oh, I hate doing this. Oh, I gotta study the Bible. Oh, I gotta go to church. All that stuff is just wrong values that need to be replaced with the correct values. Yes, correct. And then when you change your emotions, you change what you actually want to do. So from what I've heard, the research keeps saying this, is that people who exercise eventually get to the point where they really get high from exercising. The endorphins kick in, the cannabinoids or whatever. There's other ways you get your cannabinoids system to operate. It doesn't involve much pain, and it should become legal any day now. But anyway, I'd like to go back to something that I did in 1999, back in, oh, no, yeah, 19, that was a while ago. And it's a definition from Microsoft Bookshelf, which came with my computer way back then. And I put it in here for a couple of reasons. It's not bad, but it's also not accurate. So they say an emotion is an intense mental state. But it also involves physiological changes, so it's both that arises subjectively rather than through conscious effort. You don't have to think, what am I going to feel now? It's like, ow, that hurt, or that's good, or oh, or whatever that one is. So it just it arises and it varies from person to person because it's a learned thing. It's also accompanied by physiological change. Your body changes. Saber-tooth tiger, 12 o'clock high. Ah! All right. It's just like physiologically, you start pumping blood, your legs start pumping, you just, adrenaline floods, and it's a physiological change. You get a pit in the bottom of your stomach where there should have been food. Then they say an emotion is a strong feeling. All right, so they're still kind of, well, they're not alone in this confusing feelings and emotions. They also said it's the part of the consciousness that involves feeling and sensibilities. Most people, I think, would say that emotions are not conscious. You have to actually dig to find out what's going on there. Then there's this definition that I really love. An emotion is a controllable response to a stimulus. That passes through a learned value filter and it expresses itself through a learned behavioral filter. Some guy at BC did that back in 99. And that is still valid today after, dozens. I mean, I basically read two or three articles a week on this kind of stuff for the past 4 decades. Back in the day before the internet, I used to read books and work my way through it. So it's something that you can control. All right? And it's a response to a stimulus. So you get the stimulus, you don't have to make a response that everyone else makes or that you used to make because that perception passes through a learned value filter. And the way you actually express it goes through a value filter. And the same author says an emotion can be either positive, life-enhancing, or negative, which is life-destructive, can be godly or sinful. So not all responses are neutral. They can be beneficial or not beneficial. Initial responses, not good. eventually they need to get to be better. Emotional need, what's that? It's a craving that, when satisfied, leaves you with a feeling of happiness and contentment. And when unsatisfied, leaves you with a feeling of unhappiness and frustration. So basically, they're basically defining need as what makes you happy, and then, you know, the lack of that need makes you unhappy. So this comes from Harley, the guy who wrote His Needs, Her Needs. He's a psychologist who's specialized in marriage. He says there are probably thousands of emotional needs. No, I would say, sorry, Harley, these are emotional wants. And then he lists some of them. A need for birthday parties, a need for peanut butter sandwiches, a need for Monday night football. I had a few others listed. Some have them and some don't. So my favorite author, I often quote myself just when conversations get boring because it lightens it up. As I used to say, an emotional need as opposed to a desire is a perceived lack, which, if unmet, prevents you from doing the will of God. So if you are, you know, drowning in the depths of depression, you're not going to be able to kind of figure out and do what God wants you to do, is do His will, particularly if it relates to reaching out to others. If you're experiencing panic attacks, and I've talked with some people who've tried to help people who've had panic attacks, you really can't do anything. You're just like, you know, zonkers. So the thing that's kind of key here is a perceived lack, because there's always all you need to do God's will. You just think you're lacking. So you've been blinded or deceived or just ignorant of what God's purposes and plans are. And the good thing about ignorance is that it can be corrected and resolved. Or your questions are slowing me down. So this is a quote from the two guys I had for my counseling courses, Minrith and Meyer. They are both medical doctors. They run chair of a psychiatric department, Richardson Hospital. And I'm so glad I had them, because I got the, you know, I didn't get the Christian-y perspective. I got the hard medical one melded with the Christian one. And they wrote a book called The Healthy Christian Life, which I still think is really good. I haven't seen where my copy is for a number of years, but it's a really decent guide to almost whatever ails you. So in it, they quote, these personal needs that people have are intimacy with God, fellowship with other people, and self-worth. And I totally agree with that. We are wired for all three of these. We were created with desires for these things. If you look at how Satan tempted Eve and tried to tempt Jesus, self-worth was right up there. Why people rebel against God, it's usually a worth and value issue. Then they said we must have unconditional love and acceptance, a feeling of being cared for, and a lifestyle that makes an impact on others with good and lasting effects. Okay, so you might have noticed that I crossed out unconditional acceptance. Unconditional love, yeah, that's what God does for us. God does not accept people unconditionally and actually commands us to not accept them unconditionally. There are conditions for relationships. There are rules of engagement. To basically try to say, oh, I unconditionally accept. Well, I can say, I can accept another person as someone in process. I can accept them as someone who's on a journey to wholeness. But to accept them where they are when they just want to stay there, God says, actually, to the Israelite community, put them away from your midst. From the Christian community, put them out of your midst. So acceptance is not an unconditional thing, and it's a check on our behavior so that we are motivated to not just have the benefits, but engage in the, you know, character that enables us to have those benefits. Feeling of being cared for, God unconditionally loves us. He does care for us. He is our shepherd, or is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. Phenomenal psalm. Most people just rush through it because they've memorized it. But if you meditate on it and think about, wow, he actually first makes you lie down. Be still and know that I am God. And there's a whole bunch you can do out of that. A lifestyle that makes an impact on others with good and lasting effects. Disciple making anyone. This is really biblical stuff. God enables these things to happen. Our self-worth, thinking about ourselves, is enhanced to the extent that those emotions and qualities define our lives. So stuff up above. Most of you know my work on self-worth is it basically comes from knowing that I'm doing what's pleasing in God's sight, and I'll hear, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And if the God of creation thinks I'm hot stuff, then I am, regardless of what anyone else says. Yet another way of describing these basic needs is that we need a sense of belongingness, and this is totally true. Hopefully, I spelled that correctly. An assurance that we are considered worthy by someone important to us, a feeling that we are useful and competent. When I believe that someone important to me wants me and accepts me, I can regard myself as good, approved, capable, and adequate to deal with daily life, partly to satisfy that person. Now, I put the asterisk in there. If you don't have people like this in your life, which would be really nice, is Jesus important to you? Can you see Jesus meeting your needs? Do you have a sense of belonging to him? Does he consider you worthy? There's a bunch of commands on walking worthy of the Lord who calls you to his kingdom and glory. Lots of stuff on worthiness. One of these days we'll get a sermon on it. God makes us competent. He makes us useful. Fruit of the Spirit is beneficence. It actually is benefiting others. So even it's nice if you can have a person in your life for this, but if you don't have it, it's no excuse to feel horrible about yourself, because you use that. I'm doing something eventually on loneliness. Loneliness, a lot of people consider a gift who've kind of understood it, because it enables them to go and develop these skills and these thinkings and these character traits that enable them to basically be more useful and pleasing to God. And then in the process, God brings these other things into your life. My conception of, I mean, two conceptions that I had that I think have, guided me for the past 4 decades. One was to think what it meant to follow Jesus. And it was real simple. You were hiking to the next town with Jesus and those who also were hiking with him. So if you were hiking to the next town with Jesus, you were a follower of Jesus, and then you would be in fellowship with others. If you were not hiking to the next town, you were not a follower of Jesus, because where was Jesus? He was on his way to the next town. Where are you? Back where you were initially. That's not a follower. The second thing is, whatever view of the Christian life, as I was trying to put this together, I come up with, it's got to work if you are in Siberia in solitary confinement for sharing your faith with no contact with other people. And I had a friend that actually used to teach exegesis with me at the seminary. Went to another seminary for a doctorate, and he came back and he said, "Yeah, the whole purpose of life is using your gifts in the local church." To which I said to the guy, I said, "Well, how would that work if you're in a solitary confinement cell in Siberia for sharing your faith? You don't got no local church. You don't have anyone else. So you're telling me that a person couldn't live the Christian life?" Based on your definition, your answer would have to be no. For some reason, he stopped talking to me. Anyway, so I'm not going to be able to elaborate on all these things, but I want you to spend some time thinking of, do you, A, have this kind of relationship with God because Jesus is important to you? Any of these things that you're lacking are going to be detrimental to you, so you need to get them into your life. Secondly, it's nice if you can get that from some of this from others, because God does have commands like bear one another's burdens, speak the truth in love to one another, honor one another, prefer one another, look out for each other, that kind of stuff. So his plan is that this would be met in the body. So my friend was kind of right, but not in the absolute sense, because what happens if you are a missionary and you're the only one? Yeah, they killed your partner and ate him. Well, now what do you do? Well, I guess I gotta leave because I don't have, no, it's, no, God is adequate. And the third thing is we should be working on being these things to other people, and communicating that to them. Niftamaya went on to mention security, being able to regard ourselves as loved, accepted, and cared for as individuals. Believe it or not, some people don't get that growing up. They don't get it even as adults. The security is actually found in the Good Shepherd, but also they can happen in relationships. Significance is being able to regard ourselves as important and valuable to others and impacting their lives for good. How do we know if we are important and valuable to others and impacting their lives for good? Well, hopefully there's some feedback like gratitude, like thank you for that. I really appreciate that. You know, what you shared in edification, I found really useful. You know, it's just like being able to express gratitude and convey worth on others. Now, people can't do this if they don't have worth and value from God, because they think that worth and value are such a scarce commodity that if they give someone else worth and value, they'll be diminished. That's not so. If they're getting worth and value from God, it's limitless, and then we can just pass it on to others. So it's a good quote, it's a good book. I would encourage you to not, you know, just lose this chapter section and go back and you can actually read those pages. It's just like 4 pages. Any questions on that one? Yeah, if you, you know, find it, you should be able to get it for a buck on, you know, used book on Amazon. I don't think they have an updated one. I would, yeah, if you come across anything that's been different from what I said, you know, like the unconditional, just, you know, send me an email and I'll give you my 2 cents worth. Okay, I'm not going to have time to get through all this, but I hopefully will get you started in thinking about it. So I went to my friend Aristotle, and he wrote about emotions in Nicomachean Ethics, a couple, 2 other books, and he has different lists, like 11 in one, 7 in another. It varies. He's famous for, among, you know, being super bright guy and disciple of a guy he disagreed with for 20 years, which was Plato, who was a disciple of Socrates. Anger is an emotion. It's calm. And Aristotle said it's the thing he came up with is the golden mean, that you want the emotion that's kind of midway in between these two. So someone who is incapable of being angry has failed. Someone who's always angry has failed. Someone who is incapable of being calm has failed. And someone who's always calm has failed because there's time for a righteous anger. Friendship. In this list, it was not listed as a golden mean. The fear is one emotion, courage is the other. So the balance is you actually express courage in the midst of fear. Shame and confidence, it's interesting how those two go together. Most people do lack confidence because they have grown up being told things that that they're, you know, ashamed of, which aren't always true, so you kind of need to reparent yourself. Benevolence for and cruelty, pity, indignation. Indignation was an interesting one. Oh, what do you say about that? I think it was getting upset over injustice. Envy, he actually threw in love, and then in one of his other works, he threw in the concept of appetite. What I want you to notice is more than most, he included some positive emotions. Most people did not. They had one positive emotion, glad, and then between 6 and 12 were bad. Guy, you heard of Darwin? He had suffering, joy, which he also defined as love, reflection, anger, disdain, guilt, pride, surprise, fear, self-attention, and shame. Notice only one really good one, joy. Ekman. Ekman is a guy who's interesting. He put together photos and showed them to people in, like, you know, jungles who had never seen a photograph before, and asked via translators, you know, what was this person feeling? And he basically came up with six basic emotions that he claimed are universal, because people recognize them and have a word for it, which is a nice theory. There are people who totally debate it. So he had anger, disgust, happiness, sadness, fear, and surprise. Wow. Okay, so only one good one. So notice he's missing love, unless that's part of happiness, community, trust, peace, lack of anxiety, all that stuff is not there. Michelle Jack, who is a psychologist, basically reduced it to four, saying anger and disgust basically excite the same portions of the brain as do fear and surprise. And the pictures actually look kind of similar. So they actually traced the thing that gave that expression for fear or surprise, and they're back to the same neuron. Okay, Plutchik. I think that's how you pronounce the name, Plutchik. That's the one that has that wheel, and he's done some pretty good stuff. And we will look at the wheel in more depth when I can actually read it. But he had fear, anger, sadness, disgust, and surprise. But he also had joy, trust, and anticipation. And last but not least, love. So look at that. Bingo, faith, hope, and love. I'm not sure if it's, makes it right, but it does kind of match some of the biblical things that we're supposed to be striving for. Guy called Shaver doesn't draw pictures, but he has this tree of emotions. You can look him up. And basically, he's had love, joy, surprise, anger, sadness, and fear are the root, and everything else comes out of those four. So I guess that this is the thing to do. You basically move things back to their causes, and you can kind of understand, well, gee, if I'm feeling, rage, where'd it come from? Anger came from, we'll look down below. A guy that I thought, I really like him, Tony Robbins. He is kind of more of a self-made kind of guy. He's not an academic, but he has objectively looked at all the academics has, and he's basically made it work. He's kind of like a Roman, a very good pragmatist. And some of his books, Unlimited Power, are ones that I've done some sermons on. He didn't call these emotions, he called them six core needs that you kind of need to be satisfied in your life. Certainty, which is kind of like a security, but there's another one called variety. Too much certainty, too much sameness, too, makes you get bored and kind of give up on stuff because it's not stimulated enough. Too much variety can also burn you out. So there's this balance between these two. The next pack is significance or being an individual versus love and connection. So those are, now we've done three. Should have six. One, two, oh, one, two. Okay. One, two, three, four, five, six. Got them. So I talked about this earlier. Another person had done this where an individual, but you basically have to tamper being an individual and gaining all your status and everything for connection. So he works with a lot of people who are kind of have money and have gotten it because they do a lot of working, and as a result, their love and connections suffer. So you can't. God has made this world to be imperfect. Okay, basic takeaway from past sermons. If you kind of need to balance them. You can't just go all for one. You've got to kind of balance, which is why I like these wheel things, because they do show a balanced life. Although there are too many negatives in there. Growth and contribution, those are not antithetical, but you basically need to be able to grow as a person and then also be able to contribute. But you could see, he says they're not antithetical, but basically, if you spend all your time trying to improve yourself, where's the service? Because you have to put time into service. And I think I'm going to wind up leaving you with this one because my time is just about out. Let's see if the next one is. Look at that. All right, not bad. I was expecting to speak twice as fast. So as I looked at the Buddhist thing, I just came across this one that I thought was kind of interesting. So they have their categorizations. They match a lot of these other things. They've spent not just hundreds of years, but some people would say thousands of years trying to understand how people do what they do. And their conclusions need to be tempered by both scriptures and neurobiological things. And I just picked one because I had it on my screen. And it shows how these things are connected. So the Dalai Lama's view, reflecting his, school of thought, is anger basically equals mental unhappiness. So I'm just not happy. And then if that, you don't take steps to resolve that, to reduce the dissonance, to change your value, to near book, meditate, whatever that means, which is, kind of can in part be equivalent to Christian prayer, God make me more patient. It leads to something called unhappiness go unchecked goes to abiding dissatisfaction. I don't like that. I don't like that right now. All right, so you're just like dissatisfied. You're not at peace. You're not content. That leads to irritability, which means you're easily irritated. Little things can set you off. Then that builds to a proneness to anger. So now, not only does a little thing set you off, it actually evokes a negative response. And there's good anger even in Buddhism. There's constructive anger. There's righteous anger. There's many kinds of anger, and we'll look at those in more depth. But the unhappiness that gives rise to anger as opposed to injustice is something that basically unbalances your worldview. And then anything comes in. Remember I talked about how an emotion will actually affect your perception? Then you'll see even good stuff as bad, neutral stuff as bad, and bad stuff as absolutely horrible, end of the world if they can't even take it anymore. So there's a progression, and that's what that wheel and those, basically getting in touch with some of those and thinking about how you act and why you act like you do, actually will start giving you more emotional intelligence, which supposedly is helpful at work. So we'll look at that. Resentment, which can kind of contribute to the mental unhappiness, is a long feeling of being treated unjustly or unfairly. Can anyone say pointy-haired boss? When your company basically uses you and doesn't, give you comp time off or compensate you, you kind of, boy, I'm being treated unjustly. I'm being treated unfairly. And then I don't deserve to be treated like this. You start resenting it. And then I'm not happy. Yeah, I'm actually unhappy. And then I really can't stand this place. And then you have, the irritability and proneness to anger, and then you get fired. So in the next weeks, we're going to look at the stuff that follows. Sorry. I just leave you with this one. We're going to basically see how our perception of things that come into our life affects our performance. And I want to teach you, if you don't already know how to do this, how to change how you see things, how to undo the unbalanced state that your emotions and upbringing and all those other things have come in. So the basic paradigm for all the perception of performance series was our habits, which is our experience, how we were raised. And our values, which are also a function of our experience, which gives rise to desires. Why do we do it? Because we want to. Why do we want to? Because we think it's more beneficial to us than not. It's a value. Create expectations about how we and life should, and God should work. Yeah, so unfortunately, God doesn't always meet our expectations. He meets our needs, which is sometimes a smack on the head to say your expectation is wrong. That's going to influence our perception of reality and consequent emotions. So if you want to change your emotions, what do you got to change? Perceptions. But if you want to change perceptions, what do you have to change? The habits and values. Once you change the values, does everything, like your performance, is also wonderful? No, because those habits have dug those super highways in your brain that need to be ripped up and rebuilt. And it's going to take work. It takes meditation. It takes prayer. It takes focused effort. It takes memorization. It takes lots of things, which we're going to talk about in future weeks. So I'll pick up Peter's example of basically missing Jesus and in the tomb and denying Jesus, and all that was a result of incorrect perception, which is a result of his incorrect values. So that's the journey that we have ahead of us. I hope you'll join me. I hope you'll actually come up with stuff. I got emails from people, particularly of the Feeler variety, telling me how they prevented the death spiral, which are spot on. We're going to be talking about those, but that's going to be for a few more weeks. Any questions? All right, do take a look at the questions down below. Where are they? Down here. Here we are. And there's actually some good articles on psychology today about, in Huffington Post even, about controlling your emotions or they control you. There's a lot of good stuff. So we're going to basically learn how to trace things to their root and transform them to positive motivation for action. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that you're a God who made us fearfully and wonderfully. Thank you that you have perfect and wonderful plans for us based on how you created us. Thank you that you created us with emotions and you have a desire for how they should be, and you have a process for how they can be brought into conformity to your will so that we can do and delight in what you have in store for us. Thank you that your spirit is at work in us to cause us to willing to do your good pleasure. May we be able to embrace that both for our benefit, the benefit of others, and ultimately your glory. We pray all these things and give you thanks in Christ's name. Amen.